I told Jane I feel the least prepared for this class of all of them. It's just so much stuff. And I would encourage you to read the book, The Campbell Owen Debate, if you'd like to get it. I will warn you that if you're like me, you have to read it with a dictionary in one hand and the debate book in another. Because there are words I never heard of that that are all through it. And they both seem so familiar with them. But it is a difficult book. It'll make you think, but it is good. But all of Campbell's stuff is that way. Okay. Grover had his attempted colonoscopy today, and everything looked fine, except they weren't able to do the procedure quite like they wanted to. They were afraid they were going to puncture it. So they're going to do an MRI, a CAT scan next week. And let's see, Beverly Strange is going to have surgery on her vocal cords to help try to improve her voice on Monday. Terry's surgery, I think we announced last week, went well. He's at home. And Jenny Slaughter's mom is now at home. Al Gardner's back at home. And who am I overlooking? Angela Davis had her surgery yesterday, and everything went fine, and she got to come home today. Any others you know of, want to mention? Okay, let's bow together. Father, we thank you so much for your word, and we ask you, Father, to help us to depend on that word, and to know, Father, that it is through that word that you speak to us through your Son. And Father, we're so grateful for all the blessings that you give to us in him. We ask you to be with us and help us and strengthen us to be the people you want us to be, and be with us in our night tonight and through the rest of our week. And we thank you for the beautiful weather we're enjoying and the early taste of spring that we're getting. We're just so grateful for all the seasons, and we're grateful for the new beginnings and the fresh new things that are coming up. In the name of Christ, we pray. Amen. I've always called them buttercups. Jane calls them daffodils. We've got them all around our house. I don't know if y'all are seeing those yet or not, but that's always a nice thing to see. Going to start off with a little map, which y'all can't see at all, can you? Well, yeah, y'all can see that, can't you? All right, do you know where you are? You don't know where you are? This is Evansville, Indiana. This is the Ohio River heading on down. Ohio and Tennessee join right over near Paducah. And this is I-64, which is going to run over toward Memphis. And this is the Wabash River, and it's still got a few miles to go before it crosses the Mississippi. But this is New Harmony, and that's the place that we're going to start off talking about today. That is New Harmony, Indiana, and that's going to become the introduction part to our lesson today. The man that Alexander Campbell is debating in this book is named Robert Owen. He came from Scotland. He was a worker, or maybe owner, of a textile mill there in Scotland, and decided that he wanted to change some things. He has some philosophies that we're going to get into. He wanted to change some things for the working person where he owned the plant, and so he did. The first thing that he did was reduce their working hours to 10 hours a day. And then the second thing that he did after he did that was to give everybody a raise to where everybody was making a living that was worthy of the work that they were doing. And then he reduced their working hours to 8 hours a day, with the idea that he wanted individuals to have 8 hours that they worked, 8 hours of free time, and 8 hours of sleep. And that was his goal for the people that were in his plant. And this started off, and it became really popular. And the idea of what he did in that plant started to take hold and went with some other plants in Scotland. He decided, based on doing this very little with the principles that he was believing in and what he wanted to do, he decided, I'm going to do this in a community. I'm going to do this in a city. And he came and discovered that in the United States, there was a community that was one that he could purchase. And so for $200,000, he bought New Harmony, which wasn't very large at the time, but he bought New Harmony and sent out advertisements saying, we're going to start a new community, and this community is going to be one where everybody is going to be at peace. It's going to be a community where everybody is going to live in harmony, thus the name New Harmony. It'll be a place where those who work will work to have money for themselves, but also to have to share with others. And everybody will be at peace with each other, and everybody will enjoy one another, and everyone will love one another in this community that we're going to build called New Harmony. He bought it January of 1825. It lasted 2 years. There's some reasons for its failure, and we're going to just go over some that were written about it in an article about New Harmony, and then we're going to get into more detail about what it was that he believed and what it was that he was trying to accomplish. Some reasons for its failure. Owen actively attacked established religions. Not just some of them, all of them. It didn't matter what kind of religion it was. You needed to cease and desist. According to him, religion, no matter what kind it was, no matter where it comes from, is the very cause for all of our division and disharmony and anger and hatred. And he attacked established religion, every kind of established religion. Didn't matter if you were Muslim or Jewish or whatever you might be. He thought that needed to stop. He held to the principles of the rationalist age of enlightenment. Now, I'm going to throw up some words. They're not going to be all as big as this one. But just in a very simple way, the rationalist, and it's a funny use of the word here, the rationalist and the Age of Enlightenment was, you cannot know anything except by your 5 senses. The only knowledge you can have, the only way you can know anything, is by hearing it, seeing it, smelling it, tasting it, or feeling it. And if you can't do that, you can't know it. And so he held really strong to this idea. And he consistently appealed to the upper class for donations. He expected those that did work and earn money to share with those that weren't working and to share with them and so that everybody could be on the same footing and on the same basis. He also banned the owning of private property. Everything in New Harmony was communal. Everything belonged to the community. One of the descriptions of the failure was written by someone who said that it became disgusting because every bit of the food that you ate, you had to go to the general store in order to pick it up. And if you were contributing to the general store, you got a credit. Otherwise, you paid a stipulated amount if you weren't working in order to get your food, but everybody got their food at the general store. And one of the individuals involved in the city talked about it became disgusting because all of the salads for everybody in the community were at the store, and they were all in just a mess, lettuce wilted and everything else, and they were just in the store for you to come by and pick up, and you had to do all the walking to get there when you may have had a garden in your backyard and you could have made your own. But this was community. I'm not sure how far community went. I read some things, not in the debate, because Mr. Campbell didn't go there. I didn't completely finish the book, but he didn't go there with any of this. But there's some things that I read that just makes me wonder, in what areas was the community to be a community, other than just the land and just the food and just the finances part? But those are three of the reasons that are given for the city to fail. His utopian community lasted 2 years, 1825 to 1827. Now, I want to highlight those dates for you. The debate between Campbell and Owen is April of 1829. So it's 2 years after the failure of New Harmony. And after the failure of New Harmony, Owen decides to go back to Scotland. He leaves a son and evidently a daughter and another individual there, and New Harmony, once it leaves the community aspect of the things, becomes a fairly successful town and does a lot of things toward different science projects, different science things, and becomes a place that becomes pretty well known. But that wasn't the case in these 2 years. Can you think of another time in history when a similar thing happened? When the pilgrims came. When the pilgrims came, they wanted all the property to belong to everybody. They wanted everybody to work together, to create a community and everything, and that didn't take them long to realize that fewer and fewer people were working because the ones that were working had to share with the ones that weren't working. And that created some tensions and some animosities. And so the pilgrims finally decided, okay, rather than all the land belonging to the community, then we're going to divide the land up among all of those that are here. And you can do with your land what you want to. You can raise your own crops enough to feed your family. You can raise more and sell what you have left. You can do all of that, but your land is yours. It's not for anybody else, and you can do with it what you want. When they did that, then the community began to thrive. And everybody realized, if I want to eat, I need to work. If I'm going to eat, I need to get busy. And it was very interesting. New Harmony had kind of pretty much the same situation. But there are a lot of years between New Harmony and the Pilgrims. And this was here. Alexander Campbell and the Robert Owens debate. took place in April of 1829. It lasted 8 days. They debated all day long, except on Sunday. They did not meet on Sunday. It lasted for 8 days. There were over 1,200 in attendance at each session. It became an extraordinary debate written about and talked about in a lot of different places, to the point that Mr. Campbell, after this debate, became very well known, wrote a lot and talked a great deal about some of the things that Mr. Owen held to, in particular one of them being socialism. And he talked a great deal about those things. And I believe, y'all familiar with your history books of one of the statesmen of the day being a man named Henry Clay. And Henry Clay, I know, moderated a couple of the debates for Mr. Campbell. And I believe he was one of the moderators in this debate. In the debate book, that's not particularly mentioned. The moderators do a lot of talking, especially at the beginning, because Mr. Owen doesn't want to debate. He just wants to say, here's what my principles are, and the way he didn't try to prove them. He just said, if you'll just listen to me and you try them, you'll see that they work. And he didn't really engage in a debate, which was very frustrating to Mr. Campbell. But Mr. Owen only tried to describe what he believed for about the first 12 times he talked. And at the end of that, he turned all of the time over to Mr. Campbell to say whatever he wanted to say. And he spoke the rest of the time, in all the time that was allowed, and the people were just there. And I was telling Ron just a few moments ago, he was saying, well, who won the debate? At the end of the debate, Mr. Campbell asked the question of those that were there in attendance at that last meeting. Those of you who believe and understand that there's a God in heaven that we must listen to, would you stand? And everybody in the audience stood except for three people. And those three were individuals that were sympathetic toward Mr. Owen. The thing that comes out over and over and over again from both of them and from the moderators and from those that write about the debate, they've never seen two individuals be so respectful and so congenial of each other throughout the entire debate. And they talk straightforward, they talk the truth, but there were no personal attacks. There was none of those things that went on during this debate. Okay. I'm going to give you a brief summary of his beliefs. And there are 12 of them that he outlines in his first speech, which really frustrated Mr. Campbell. That's when he got up and said, there's not a proposition here. In debating, we present a proposition that you prove to be true, and I will try to negate that proposition and show why it's not true. There's no proposition here. There are just statements about what you think everybody ought to be doing and everybody ought to be believing, but there is no proof whatsoever for why they should be doing it. And he said to the moderators, I don't know that we need to continue if this is what we're going to do. And the moderators talked pretty straightforward to Mr. Owen and said, you're going to have to do this. Well, he gave his next speech and he didn't do it. So when they came back the next day, the moderators got up and they outlined four or five things and said, this is what you stated in the newspaper article that brought about this debate. And so these are the things you must hold yourself to and present proof on in a propositional form. Well, he does that, and he begins to enumerate these things, although he doesn't really give proof of them. And that continues to be a frustration throughout with regard to the debate. But here are the things, and I'm going to try to explain them to you a little bit. And I'll tell you, this is going to get weird. But I will also tell you, but you may already be used to the weirdness. All religions of the world have been founded on human ignorance. I don't want to jump ahead, and I think I'm going to. We'll come back to that in a minute as to why. Why he would say that. But I want you to notice something as we begin to go through. This man quotes scripture. This man uses religious terms. This man will talk about being created by the deity, being created by the supreme deity. And he talks about the creator. But what you have to understand is that when he says deity, he means nature. When he says the creator, he means nature. And that's something that I want you to keep in mind as we go through. All religions of the world, doesn't matter what they are, have been founded on human ignorance. Why does he say that? Let's go to the next one. Those religions are directly opposed to the never-changing laws of our nature. Our nature is such, it's never-changing, and yet religion is trying to change us. And they are ever in opposition to the never-changing laws of our nature. They have been and are the real sources of vice, disunion, and misery of every description. This is his proof and evidence that all religions must go, and that all religions must be done away with. They are now the only real bar to the formation of a society of virtue, intelligence, sincerity, and benevolence. The real bar means they're the only thing standing between us and a successful society that shows nothing but virtue, intelligence, sincerity, and benevolence. You know what Mr. Campbell's reaction was to those? What he tried to get him to do was define what you mean by religion. He said, because with what you're saying right here, I would probably be in complete agreement with every religion but one. And what do you think the one religion would be? And don't say Church of Christ. The one revealed by God. The one that holds to God's revelation of himself. The one that listens to what God actually said. And so he would say, I probably would be in agreement with you on all of these, so what are we talking about? Except one. So let's go a little further. That they can no longer be maintained except through the ignorance of the ma- of, of the mass of people and the tyranny of the few over the mass. When Owen started this, Mr. Campbell writes an introduction to the debate, and he says that one of the problems with Owens is he's not familiar with individuals who want to return to what God's Word says. He's familiar with denominations that hold the creeds or to the Roman Catholic Church. That's what he's familiar with, and he's not familiar with those individuals who say, let's put aside all of man's creeds and let's just go to what the Bible says. And let's listen to what God actually says. And he kind of says something to that effect in the introduction. Okay, his divine laws, divine, that means the laws that come from nature. Now look at this and think about it. I want you to think and kind of work your way through. We'll go through them one at a time. I think I'm going to have three on this page, on this screen, and then three more on the next. He listed 12, but because of the moderator's insistence and his agreement to it, the debate hinged around the ones I'm about to put up, not all 12 of them. But these are kind of a summary of all the 12. Man at birth is ignorant of everything relative to his own organization. That he has not been permitted to create any part of his faculties, qualities, or powers, physical or mental. This, he says, is divine law number one. The law of nature number one is that when you are born, you are totally ignorant about who you are and what you're about. You have not been permitted to have any say-so whatsoever in any part of your faculties, qualities, or power. You don't even get a say-so in if you're right-handed or left-handed. I'd debate that. I may take that one back. Because I have a son who's totally confused. And the reason he's totally confused is when he was born, we typically sat on his left side to feed him. And so when he started feeding, he fed from his left side and he picked up the spoon with his left hand. As he grew older, we noticed he couldn't decide which hand he wanted to use. If he was writing or coloring, he used his left hand. If he was throwing a ball, he would use his right hand. All of his power skills were right-handed. All of his motion skills were left hand. I loved playing him in racquetball because sometimes you hit hard, sometimes you hit finesse, and he didn't know which way to hold the racket. And I say I love that. He didn't like playing racquetball. We didn't play a whole lot. But that's sort of going to be kind of illustrious a little bit of what he's trying to say. But isn't that true? Did you decide who you wanted to be, what color hair you wanted to have? How you wanted to be when you were born? That's typical of all humanity. Okay? Let's see where we're going with this. Since we have no control over the formation of ourselves, we are not responsible. That's his second law. It is obvious to everybody who thinks and just looks that when you're born, you have absolutely no control over what you're going to be, what you're going to look like, what color your hair is going to be. You have no control over anything whatsoever. and this doesn't change, is what he will say. And he says that because we have no control over who we are and what's put inside of us from the very beginning, then we are not responsible. We are not responsible for what we do. And we'll get to his conclusions about this in just a minute. But let's go a little further with these divine laws. If you need me to back up, I will. Each individual is placed at birth within the influence of circumstances which operate irresistibly upon his peculiar organization, and these circumstances stamp their own general character on the infant. You want to scratch your head? You want to back up? You want to take a nap? You want to come back to it after you've got your head cleared? Here's basically what he means, and he's going to show that in just a second when we look at the next one. You're born. You have no control over you, what you're going to look like, what the color of your eyes are going to be, or you don't have any control whatsoever over anything about you when you're born. But then you're born and you're put in a family. You're given a mom and a dad. And you may be given brothers and sisters, or you may be the first one. And you, by your mom and dad, have a force operating on you as to what they say is right and what they say is wrong, what you are to do and what you are not to do. And because this is the case with you, not just at birth, but in the situation you're put in, as you begin to grow, you're going to have all of these irresistible forces around you, your parents, your teachers, and others that are going to implant in you things that you're never going to get rid of. Therefore, you're not responsible. You're not responsible for anything. Now, he goes further with this, and he says, this is the reason why if we learn God's, when he says God, not God, if we learn our Creator, nature's laws, then we cannot help but be more patient with other people. Because we will realize they are like they are because those are the irresistible forces that were placed in them. And I am what I am because those are the irresistible forces that were placed inside of me. And they are no more responsible for being who they are than I'm responsible for being who I am. So therefore, we just need to learn to accept one another and love one another because we are what nature has made us to be. Y'all having some problems with this yet? If you're being convinced by him, just hold on. Each individual is liable to imbibe false and injurious notions are their opposite and retain them with great tenacity. Because you're going to be bombarded by all these things from those that are around you and the environment that you're in. You're going to be bombarded by all of these things. And some of those things are going to create in you things that others would think are wrong. And they're going to create in you things that others are going to consider harmful and causing injury, as well as things that would be good and right. Those things are all going to be there. And when those things are embedded in you, you will hold on to them with great tenacity. Y'all still have problems with things that you had problems with when you were a kid? For a long time, I had a problem with a word. My mom and my dad, if there was something on the stove in a pot, they would say, go stir the pot. Because all their life, they had heard the word stir. And it was in college before I finally got that I was saying stir and people were snickering and I wasn't saying stir. I had a very close friend of mine. Many of you know him, Ralph Gilmore. He teaches philosophy, taught philosophy before he retired at Fried Hartman University. I was listening to Ralph in a open forum one time at Fried Hartman when I was at the Fried Hartman lectures. And let me get the thing right. Let me just think a minute. You've got a dresser and it's got drawers. What do you call it? Huh? Yes. He said, he got up in the open forum and he says, I have learned this week that it's a chest of drawers, not chest of drawers. And when he said that, I said, well, Ralph, I've learned it just this moment. Because all of my life I've been told, go to the chest of drawers. They didn't say, go to the chest of drawers and get those whatever I want out. Chest of drawers, that's what they were. Anybody else like that? And you hold on to what you've heard with great tenacity. But do you know just what happened that disproves everything he's just said? Well, just hold on to it and think about it. We'll come back in just a second. Each individual is created so that he must believe according to the strongest impressions made on his feelings and faculties. Every one of us are created to the point that we must do what we have always been taught that we must do. Now, if you catch where he's wrong in the one before that one, it's easy for you to catch where he's wrong in this one. I want you to look at Mr. Campbell's summaries and thinking about everything that's here. So far. Any questions about this so far? I don't want to throw stuff at you and any questions yet? Well, y'all are either doing great or you're having a very good nap. One of the two. Campbell's response. Mr. Campbell summarized everything he says in this debate in one sentence. And that one sentence is this. Man did not make himself, and consequently is irresponsible. That is, all religions must be false. Man didn't make himself. Because he didn't make himself, he can't be responsible for anything that he does. And if he can't be responsible for anything that he does, then why in the world are we trying to teach people to change? Our religions are false. You got to keep in mind what we talked about last week. And this was when Mr. Campbell and Mr. Owen met at Mr. Campbell's farm before the debate started. And that was when they were walking in the field and Mr. Owen said to Mr. Campbell, Mr. Campbell, I have an advantage over you Christians. Mr. Campbell said, how so? And Mr. Owen said, because I have no fear in death. And Mr. Campbell said, you have no fear in death. No, I have none. Well, Mr. Owen, do you have any hope in death? And Mr. Owen said, well, no, I suppose no. I don't have any hope in death. What does he think is going to happen when he dies? That's it. It's the end of it. You won't ever know anything else. There will not be anything else. When you die, that's it. It's over. Period. Nothing. And no, I don't have any fear in death, but I don't have any hope either. And then Mr. Campbell said, then you're like my cow here. My cow has no fear in death, and my cow has no hope in death. You're just like my cow. And he's about to make an even stronger suggestion and impression. But he adds this to it in the book, to this. If you have no responsibility, then there's nothing about you worthy of praise. Because if you have no control and you don't cause anything to happen, and therefore you are not responsible for it happening, then there is no reason to say thank you. There is no reason to praise. And what Mr. Campbell points out is, you, by your laws of nature, are destroying the very foundation of society. You're destroying the very foundation of what society is built upon. And he's going to show it in a little better way as we go through. According to what you're saying, Mr. Owen, no man can be responsible for anything bad or good any more than a stone. Nobody can be responsible for anything any more than a stone that's in the road. And that's really where he's coming from, because he's wanting all the laws that apply to humanity to apply from nature. And he wants us to be just like this. Let me bring you to a more modern one that says exactly the same thing Mr. Campbell said here. And I've mentioned this before. Tom Warren, one of my teachers at Fried Hardeman, was telling us this story. I think he had been on a trip, and I think he was telling it to us shortly after it happened. It may not. It may have happened sometime earlier. But he was on a trip, and you have to keep in mind, Dr. Warren was a doctor of psychology, and he taught. He was the head of the psychology department, and actually also the head of the Bible department when I was there. And he taught us in psychology. He gets on a plane, and a lady sits down beside him, and they have greetings, and they get to talking, and come to find out, she is a professor of psychology at a university. And he lets her know he's also a professor of psychology at Fried Hardeman College. It wasn't a university at the time, but it was a college. And so they get to talking. She reveals to him that she's on her way to deliver a speech. And it's a speech with regard to the adoption of children. And she's looking forward to getting there and delivering her speech and try to encourage these individuals that are in the process of adopting children. And he listened to her, intrigued by what she was saying, and he finally just before the plane came in for a landing, he said, do you mind if I ask you a question? And she said, no, go ahead. And he said, is it true or is it not true that you are a materialist? By a materialist, he meant the same thing that Stone's talking about, not Stone. Owen. The same thing that Owen is talking about with regard to naturalism, that we are all matter, and that's all we are. There's no soul in us. There's no spirit in us. There is no God. Everything is matter, and that's all that there is. So she's a materialist. And that word has different definitions, different meanings. And she said, yes. And he said, so am I to understand that in your understanding of things, you and I are no different from a rock? That a rock is made out of matter, and you and I are made out of matter. And in essence, there is absolutely no difference between you and a rock. And she says, that's exactly right. We are all matter, and that's all that we are. And there's no difference between you and I and a rock in the field. And he said, well, then I'm very intrigued. And I'm wondering, with regard to the children that you're about to go and speak to people who are going to adopt them about, why would you feed the child and step on the cockroach? Why wouldn't you instead feed the cockroach and step on the child? There was this period of silence. And she finally looked at him, and the credit to her was she was honest and would evaluate things. And she finally looked at him and said, I can't answer your question, but one thing I will tell you, you have ruined my speech. Campbell saw that, and he hits at it pretty hard. He says this, while Mr. Owing is trying to rid us of bad feelings, which is what he's trying to do. He's trying to get us to feel good about everybody and love everybody. And while he's trying to rid us of bad feelings, he's destroying the foundations of society. There is nothing good or bad about anybody. Nobody's responsible for anything. The adult is constantly changing his circumstances. There is not a more common incident in human life nor a more common phrase in the human language than change one's circumstances. Do y'all get that? I don't have to go through my life saying steer. I can look it up in a dictionary and realize it's the wrong word. Steer refers to the cow. Stir refers to what you do to the pot. Or steer refers to what you do to the steering wheel on a car. And I can go to a dictionary and find out what words mean. And I can change my circumstance as to how I use words. You can change your circumstance regardless of what that circumstance might be. You change your circumstance, you change your feelings. Well, actually, that's not the first thing. Change your circumstance, you begin to change your mind. You change your mind, you change the way you look at things. Change the way you look at things, you change the way you feel about things. You change your circumstance. And all of us have the ability to do that. I was brought up, put right in the middle of a family. On one side, I just take mom and dad. Her family. My granddad was a sharecropper. They lived in a house that when it snowed, the snow came through the roof, came into the blankets. They lived in a house where the only heat inside of the house was a coal-burning stove in one room. And Grandpa and Grandma got that room, and nobody else did. And if you had to go to the potty and you didn't want to use the can that was under the bed, then you had a walk of about 150 yards to the outhouse. And no matter how cold it might be. And They lived in this house all of their life, being sharecroppers for a doctor that was in Coleman. Some of my best times were at that house. Some of my most enjoyable times were at that house. I learned very early on from the strong, tremendous influence my grandfather had and my uncle had, you still did not want to listen to everything they said. And you still did not want to do everything they did. Because I can change my circumstance. I can see and understand what my parents and what God would have me to do. And I can change. And not be overwhelmed by them. When we develop reason, we develop responsibility. My niece took her newborn baby to see our family physician, who was our pediatrician. He's the one that got me, Larry, and Gary, and Keith, all of us up into high school. And he actually saw me for the last time when I was in college, and he finally said, you might need to see somebody other than a pediatrician. But I was with him all through those times, and my niece, Gary's daughter, had Gary's first grandchild, and she went to see Dr. Pitt. She went in to see Dr. Pitt carrying her three-month-old for his three-month checkup. And while she was in there, she looked at Dr. Pitt and said, Dr. Pitt, how old does he need to be when I start teaching him the word no? And Dr. Pitt whipped off his glasses. He looked at her and he said, you mean you haven't already? Changed circumstances. It's part of helping them to understand there's certain circumstances that need to be changed. The basis of all obligation or responsibility, Alexander Campbell said, I consider to be dependence. A being independent of any other has no rule to obey but that which his own reason or will prescribes. You see that? The basis of all obligation or responsibility I hold to be dependence. A man depends absolutely upon his Creator for everything. It is necessary that he should, in all points, submit to his will. Do you see how much that is? Do you know that you can't take the next breath without God's air mixed just exactly right with what we need to go into our lungs and go through our blood system to give us life? And if we can't breathe his air, we don't live. We don't live if he doesn't create for us an atmosphere that we're dependent upon. In the air we breathe, the water that we drink, the food that we eat, the temperature, the body that we have, and the way it functions, the way the heart beats and the blood flows and the way the brain functions and warns us and all of the, we are absolutely and totally dependent upon God in everything. Therefore, because we are dependent upon Him, it is absolutely necessary that in all points we submit to His will. Where are you going when you die? Well, that depends on what I've done with Him. I had a conversation today. I don't think they'd mind sharing it. It was we had a, it was a good conversation, but there was a point that occurred to me in the conversation I thought I'd want to share tonight. Sometimes you hear people say, oh, I love God. I want you to think about some individuals who would say that, oh, I love God, and put that in connection with a love for a husband or a wife. What would happen in a marriage if some individual's love of God was exactly the same in the love for their spouse? What if I declared my love for my spouse, but I never listened to her? I never paid any attention to her. I never did what I knew she wanted. I always did what I wanted, even though I knew it was something she didn't want me to do and had very strong reasons for me not to do it. What kind of love would it be where I said, yes, I love you, but I never listened to nor cared about anything she said? I dare say there's none of us that would call that love. And you remember Jesus saying, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. We're dependent on him. Without him, we don't have forgiveness. Without him, we don't have hope. Without him, we don't have promise. We are dependent upon him. Therefore, if you love me, what I say will be important to you. If you love me, what I want will be what you're striving to want. If you love me, what I say is something you will listen to. And so what Mr. Campbell comes down to is the one religion that goes contrary to all of this and brings us to where we need to be is the religion that knows that God has spoken and listens to what he says. Every other religion is a farce. Every other religion will destroy humanity. The only one that will save, the only one in which there is hope, is the one that listens to what God says, thus showing love and trust in him. Thank y'all. Enjoyed the quarter. I'm sorry, but you are with me again next quarter. But we won't be talking about this. We're going to be talking about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And Lord willing, we'll see you next Wednesday.